How do we start the show?
Sorry, how do we start the show?
Hey, Nora.
Hey, Sandy.
How's it going?
I'm good. Hello, Edmonton. We are so happy that you are here on this beautiful, beautifully sunny Saturday afternoon. And for the folks listening at home, I know it's Tuesday, but we're back in the past still. And we are so happy to be here. Sandy, you had a bit of a difficult time getting here.
Oh my gosh. It was a little bit of a disaster. I had a great flight from LA to Vancouver, but the flight from Vancouver to Edmonton sucked. I was supposed to get in at midnight. I didn't get in until like 3:30 in the morning, which means I didn't go to bed until like 4:30 in the morning. I was a little nervous that I wouldn't even make it here. I was like, oh my gosh, what if I don't make it? And Nora has to do this episode all by herself, with your help, I guess, of course, dear audience. But I did make it, but I am a little tired. So I'm just going to be on my A game today, basically, is what I'm saying.
And of course, that meant that we didn't get to do the 6-hour prep that we usually
that
do.
That we never, ever, ever do.
That we never do.
So it'll be just exactly the same as every other episode. It'll be great.
Now, I actually have some amazing news.
Ooh.
I have amazing news, and I'm so excited to tell you that, guys, this. So my family is friends with someone from Gaza, and we gave them money and are fundraising the money back. We got them out. They got out and they're in Egypt. They got out yesterday. And so this is someone who was in Canada for a really short-term research fellowship, just a couple of months, so didn't bring his family because obviously it's a lot of work to have your kids here when you're trying to do research. And October 7th happened, and he was trapped in Canada in Quebec City. He doesn't speak French. He speaks English, but doesn't speak French. And so we've become friends with him. And so his 5 children, ages 1 to 12, and his wife and mother and brother are all out and safe. So,
Nora, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to donate, still you can. You can check out our GoFundMe because the cost was $40,000. We're trying to raise $20,000 more for rent in Cairo. But we're not going to recoup all of it because we're going to donate the rest. So, yeah. So I'm so happy. I'm so happy. And it's, you know, it's important to be happy when we can because I don't know about you. I know about you. but things are not going so well these days.
No. It is. It's really critical to have these hopeful moments. And that's a really hopeful moment. I mean, we spoke a few weeks ago, I think, or maybe it was even just last week, about how few people have been actually able to be helped from the infrastructure that has been set up in Canada to help people. So it does feel so dire often when taking a look at, like, what is it that I can do? What can we do? And then we hear stories like this and see some of the resistance that's happening on college campuses that people are engaging in their communities. And that hopefulness, oh my God, it's so necessary. It's so necessary. It totally feeds me when I, like, you know, take a look at what the rest of the world is right now. Like, 2 stories of self-immolation in the last week.
It's unbelievable.
Like that? Did you folks see that? Those 2 stories? So one you may have seen more than the other. I mean, we're in Alberta, so it may be the case that folks know more here about what happened. But I'll tell the one about what happened in America, in front of the Trump trial. Someone self-immolated, and you know, in the immediate aftermath, people were trying to figure out. You know, was this related to the trial? Was this someone who was a supporter of Trump? Or was this someone who really wanted to see Trump be held accountable? It was, you know, someone who had a lot of conspiracy theories and had thrown up a bunch of pamphlets just before and thought that the world was engaged in a sort of Ponzi scheme that was being jointly run by Trump and Biden. That was his narrative. And when you look at his, you know, not to make any sort of judgments. I don't know this man. He was 37. But his social media feed was, you know, like totally normal up until 2022 when his mother dies and he has a post about his mother passing away. And then it's silent for a while. And then conspiracy theories. And you see like his friends posting, "Are you okay, man? Like, what's up? Are you good?" And then to have that result in this, I think, you know, there's all sorts of things that could point to, but certainly when we're all feeling the impacts of a society that seems to have abandoned its people and taking care of its people, it's hard not to put those two things in relation with one another.
Mm-hmm. And that first story, I'm sure most of you've seen some news from Red Deer of a student having self-immolated there. Now, we don't actually know anything else because the police and the Polytechnic haven't put out any information at all. You know, while you were talking, I was thinking about how necessary it is for us to sidestep official structures, because the official structures are in collapse, in decline, not helping us, not serving us in a way that they're supposed to. And thinking back to Gaza, you know, I'm actually working on an update to the piece that I wrote 6 weeks ago. Do you know how many people have come since the last report? How many people Canada has able to bring from Gaza to Canada? Any guesses? No, it is still zero. It's still zero. And what is so, I mean, it's ranging in like a million different ways. But there have been no extra approvals granted. There have been no extra, adding people. Remember Mark Miller, the Minister of Immigration, was like, well, okay, 1,000 people was pretty low. We're going to just allow more people to come. So at the very least, we're going to add people to the list. And so it's like, okay. So reporting, you know, the big last kind of time of reporting all this was March 11th or so a month ago, more than a month ago. And at that time, there was 986 people of that 1,000 that Canada had said, yes, you can, you know, we're going to go through your process with you. So they hadn't been approved, but they've been accepted to go through the process. And then Mark Miller comes in and is like, I know it's too low, we're going to have more. And so it was 986. Do you know how many it is today? 986. They haven't added anyone to their list. And there is about 160 people who are out of Gaza, like the family that I've helped. Although they're a different case because their relative is here on a work visa, so they're actually not at all looking at part of the relief programming from Canada. But there's about 160 people who are in Cairo. And you know, it's like, okay, so they're out. They've been approved to come to Canada. So I was like, hey, okay, so cool. Thanks for this information, Global Affairs Canada. What is stopping them from getting on a plane tomorrow from Cairo to, I don't know, Istanbul to Toronto or to Montreal? Like, why? What is stopping them from coming to Canada? And Global Affairs Canada says to me, it's up to them to come. Nothing's stopping them.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I haven't reported this yet. So this is a scoop for you, Edmonton, and then everyone listening.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
That's what they said?
Yes.
Our institutions just fully aren't working. Like, not just asleep at the wheel, like, but contemptibly not working.
Right.
That's outrageous.
So, I mean, now I'm looking to find to like people who I talked to before and who I haven't yet talked to who have family in Egypt. And it's like, sorry, is this true? Like, what is going on here? How is there such a colossal failure of global affairs in this situation to actually do something? You know, and then we can, of course, talk about the 900 people that were brought to Canada by Canada from Ukraine, right? Paid for by the Canadian state. The planes that are sent to actually bring people. No. You have to pay for yourself. Okay, fine. But still, nobody, not one person. So when we're thinking about fighting against these systems, I think, you know, one of the things we have to rid ourselves is the illusion that any of these systems work.
Yeah.
And they did work. And we have memory of them working. And we might even have memory of them working from like 5 years ago. And then the older you get, like time starts to make even less sense. And then you're like, you know, 20 years ago, you know, 1980. <It's> like, no.
20 years ago will always be 1980 to me.
Shit. But you know, so we have these, and we, I mean, if we're activists and we understand the difficulties that we're fighting against, blah, 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 and we still can feel the vestiges of what had been for an average person who's just trying to get by and not that interested in politics, and politics makes them mad, so not really going to read that much about politics, it's a real cognitive dissonance between what we think is supposed to be reality and what reality actually is.
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to politicians nowadays, you'll often hear them too talk about, you know, like, we need more tools, we need more resources, we need more whatever. And it just seems like so impossible as a person who's, you know, struggling, who's living real life, to listen to that and be like, what more resources could you possibly have? You have the ability to create institutions. I know this because you do it. You just created an AI institution that none of us know what that is or what it's going to do. So you do it. You do it. You create the institutions. You have the ability to spend countless amounts of money. We know that because you do it when you're giving out tax credits, when you want to spend money on war, when you want to spend money on things that aren't actually helping people. So when you are turning to us and you're saying you need more resources, what exactly are you talking about? It is us who needs more resources, and it is your job to provide that for us. That is how society is supposed to work. That is the kind of agreement we've come up with in order to survive together as a collective, because we must do that. But no, we're turning more and more into a society where the folks on the bottom are in service to the people at the top, turning. I mean, we're there. We're fully there. We are fully there. And I mean, Nora, you had an experience this morning that I think kind of really spells out how often or how dire the situation is, how abandoned we have become, and how so much of this, you know, our politicians, what their priority is more about how things look than about how things actually are.
Yeah, I want to shout out Angie and Kinnan. Are you folks here? Yeah! Everyone clap, 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 clap. Okay, so they were so, so, so generous to let me come along and do some street outreach work this morning, and we were having a conversation, which was a conversation that I've also had with Sandy, about security and who is safe, who is made safe in our society. And there was like how many times this morning and how many times and every time someone goes out that there is a situation of insecurity. Someone who is ill, someone who needs help, someone who is not safe. And unless someone helps them, they are going to be injured or die, right? Like really, really insecure. And not 20 feet away are the cops. And their job is to keep people safe. Right? And it's like, oh, I got someone for you who needs help. He's not safe. Come. It's like a fisherman, right? There's a bunch of fish here. Come and get some fish, right? Come help this guy. He needs some help. But it doesn't work like that because they're not actually there to keep that person safe. They're there to keep the truck safe or the window safe or the rich guy to feel even more safe than he already does in his gilded palace.
Not even safe, comfortable.
Safe and very comfortable.
Yeah, because the idea with that is, you know, the conversation around houselessness and homelessness, not being able to secure shelter, is often, if you hear it on the news, it's like, our streets are so unsafe. Look, there are tents.
I can't walk in the park. My name's Kristen Raworth.
Like, I know something happened. I know something happened on Twitter yesterday that I am not aware of, because I saw like a tweet about it, about Kristen Raworth, and then I was like, I don't want to know this. So I decided not to. But eventually I will know what that joke means. but a tent makes you unsafe. A group of tents makes you unsafe. What are we talking about here? It's like, you know, in my undergrad, I took this class called semiotics.
Oh, yeah. Does anyone... We didn't have that at my university because it was not a real university.
Does anyone know what semiotics is for the nerds in the audience? Okay, semiotics is the study of signs, and like the, you know, there's everything is a sign, like language is a sign. There's a signifier, which might be the word, and the signified, what the word means. Unsafe is like the distance between the signifier and the signified on that is it seems to be getting wider, you know, like I see tense, I am unsafe. I don't, like, that doesn't mean the same things. If what you are saying is these tense make me uncomfortable, and perhaps we should do something to make sure that anyone who's feeling uncomfortable, maybe some of the people who might be in the tents, I don't know, like we should maybe do something as a community to make sure that people are safe and secure, like that would be a great conversation that we can have. But this like sort of weird, I see this thing that makes me uncomfortable. Well, let's interrogate that. Why does it make you feel uncomfortable? Why don't we start there instead of let's make it so that I can't see it? Because that, I mean, that is the way that cities, governments are engaging with this issue. It's, again, the abandonment of people. It is social policy that has created this situation, and it's social policy that is going to either resolve or make it worse. But saying, like, can you clean that up? As though literally treating people as though they are garbage, as though they are not human, as though they are not worthy of consideration. I mean, from Gaza to this city, you know, that is the rot that we are, like, that causes the despair that we feel when we're like, what the fuck is going on in our societies right now? Like, are we really the type of society, do we want to be the type of society where we are more concerned with the way things look than the way things are? Who is unsafe? Who is being kept safe? And whose comfort matters more than whose fucking life and livelihood?
Yeah, well, you posed a question, and unfortunately the answer is the lives of the Edmonton Oilers. And the lives of the Katz family.
Tell me more.
Well, you know, it's actually very interesting to see how in every Canadian city, there's always a dominant family. You know, I was out.
It's true.
I was out on Thursday night. We are going to shout out Michael Jantz for making this happen, but I'm going to mention, yes, we'll do that later, but we can do it now, whatever. I was out with Michael the other night with a colleague of mine, a friend of mine who's from London, Ontario, and Michael was explaining the Katz family to us, and she says, oh, like the Farhis, which is her city's version of the Katz, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that every, you know, other than, like, Toronto, which is a real city with, like, a bourgeoisie, right? It's not one person, it's, like, literally the center of power. Montreal as well, Vancouver as well. But every other city in Canada has these, like, little nouveau riche shitheads with no taste. Like, at least have taste. Like, at least the old rich have taste. Right?
Actually?
Yeah, man.
I don't know if I agree with that. I don't know. Somebody got me into watching The Crown, and it's very confusing, the type of spaces that they want to sit in all the time. It's like, ew.
Okay, fine. That's true. I can't imagine the royal family caring about the Oilers. No, that's the nouveau riche part, right. Every city is dominated by these little seigneurs, we would say in French, like these little fiefdoms. And as things are collapsing and falling apart, they see the moment to pounce and be like, oh, do you know what would be better than a drop-in center here? Literally nothing. That's what we want to do. We want to clear this whole area of Edmonton so that when we win the cup, they can watch outside. And we can charge them $5 to watch outside, right? Because you know that's coming.
You can name it after them, though. Have their name emblazoned somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And they probably, yeah. And they get to give the key of the city off and fucking be like, yeah.
Maybe even the Order of Canada.
They probably will get the Order of Canada.
Yep.
That's right. Yeah, and then the Companion, and then all those other Knight of Canada, fucking, it goes up. There's like...
I don't know that much.
I only know a little bit more.
Okay.
I'm going to be so conflicted when I finally win it. It's going to be like... I can't say no to that. I mean, yes. But you have these like literally like shitty families that control our downtowns, and as things are falling apart, they buy all these things up, and they and in every part of Canada, the land is still the most valuable thing. Mm-hmm. The land is still the most valuable thing in this country. And whether that is the land to mine it, whether that is the land to develop it, whether that is the land to do fucking nothing with, it is still the land. And that's not surprising because we are still a colony, right? Mm-hmm. We still have a colonial economy. We still have colonial mindsets. Like, you can look at a lot of former British colonies and, like, they are way more advanced in their, like, intellectual understanding of themselves as a nation, right? We are not. And as, you know, the social safety net has completely tattered and people are getting more desperate and people are getting more afraid, that grasping of land becomes actually the only thing that anyone with any power really has to hold on to. And so we see this as huge energy projects, obviously, as pipelines, as mining, as dams, you know, all of these huge uses of land. But then we also see this in, oh, well, I don't have a public pension and I need to invest in the private sector and my pension needs to grow by 5% every year, so I'm going to invest in a REIT. And this REIT, to make 5% every year, has to jack up its rent by 8%. And now a third of Canadians live in housing, rental housing, that is owned by these fucking hedge funds. Like, I don't know. If I was going to design a society, I think that would get, like, an F. And, like, skull and crossbones and don't do that. That's fucking bad news. That's a bad idea. Because what is going to happen is things are going to get worse. And then the fight for land becomes the fight for health and the fight for freedom and the fight for security. And then it becomes scarce. And then I'm talking as like it's in the future. It's not in the future. It's up the street from here. It's up the street from here. It's in every single downtown. I mean, if you go around Ontario downtowns are full of people who are desperate, mm-hmm. because they have nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. And whether it's I'm talking about Ontario because I mean these are cities that like never really had such a homeless crisis before because people could afford to live somewhere, and people are being pushed out. I mean, Alberta's a little bit lucky in the affordability area because I mean it's expensive, but it's not like Waterloo expensive or Peterborough expensive or St. Catharines expensive. And if you've ever been to any of those places, you'd be like, "This is expensive."
Yeah.
What the fuck? This is the worst claptrap house I've ever seen in my life. Yeah, $400,000.
Yeah. Has anyone been following what's happening in the United States around the Supreme Court, challenge around cities being able to make homelessness illegal? Some people are nodding, some people are shaking their heads. I feel like it's relevant. Like, we try to keep it very Canadian focused, obviously, but I feel like this is so relevant because very often what happens in the United States finds its way to Canada. So I think it's something that we should be watching. Now, there is a ruling already in the United States that says that you can't make homelessness illegal. You cannot take people to jail for sleeping on the streets because they have nowhere else to go, which that sort of a ruling kind of says to the city, it is your responsibility, to do something here to provide shelter. Like, that's something that you must do. Now, some of these, like, ridiculous policymakers are like, well, we do provide some sorts of shelter, but these people want to sleep on the streets because we have rules in our shelter that they don't want to follow. Like, you know, they can't bring their pets, or they need to adhere to these rules. This particular shelter is like a Christian shelter, so they need to take these oaths before they come in. Like, it's that kind of ridiculousness. And they're saying those people who are refusing to come into these shelters should go to jail, because that's a choice now. Ridiculous.
Not to that shelter, to that shelter.
Absolutely ridiculous. There's not enough shelter spaces regardless. We all know this, right? So anyway, there's this particular city called Grants Pass. And I'm just going to pause here to tell you a little bit about Grants Pass, because I've actually been to this city. It's a small city in Oregon. And in a couple of years ago, I don't know what time is anymore since the pandemic, but a couple of years ago, I had to drive up from LA to Vancouver. It's a long story. We'll talk about it in the reception. And one of the cities that I stopped in to get some gas late at night when I was driving with a friend was Grants Pass. And I get out to, like, put gas in my car, and then the gas station attendant comes out, stands in front of me, and stares at me. And I was like, oh, this feels not good. My friend, who appears white, scurries out of the car, is like, hello. And the guy, like, stares at him too. And we were like, do you have a bathroom? And he says, not for you. And we were like, we're done with the gas. And we get back in the car, and we realize, we like search in the history of this town. It used to be a sundown town. And apparently still is. So in any case, that's the kind of town that is taking this ruling to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has decided they're going to hear on it. They're going to listen to it. And it's obviously a very conservative court right now. And the idea is that these cities want to be able to literally say, you don't have a place to go, and as a result, you are a criminal. We are going to incarcerate you for that. It is more expensive for them to do that work of arresting people, of incarcerating them, of creating like a ridiculous fine structure that results in incarceration in the end. It is far more expensive to do that than to provide affordable housing to people in a community. What is going on? What is this about?
Well, back in 1946, Canada had this idea that they didn't want people to have nowhere to live. And it's actually an interesting history to look at Canadian housing policy. It was very tied to the war, so it was, you know, veterans coming back and maybe being injured, maybe not being able to work. And people started to live in tents. There were a lot of tents erected throughout the 30s and then right after World War II. And they had canvas tents, so none of these like newfangled nylon tents, like real heavy canvas tents, and families were living in them. And cities were saying, this is a problem because it's not sanitary, it's not safe, like the tent could blow over, it's not warm, they're starting fires. Like, oh, that sounds so familiar. So what does the Canadian government do? Well, rather than saying, let's make it illegal and throw them all in jail, they come up with a housing strategy that actually very intentionally removes profit from the equation of housing. I mean, novel. And so people were expected to pay for housing based on the cost that it cost to make the housing. Now, this was, though, in a period of time where Canada was trying to build itself as this white Christian nation. And so we have to always see social services as being part of a racist construction of Canada, you know? And so there's this good and bad with all of our social services, where it helps a lot of people, but it actually did so to make white people have white children and make Canada white, right? And so, because we can go even further back, and the first time, anyone know the first time the Canadian government got into the housing world? Maybe you know this. Anyone know this? Anyone know the first time Canada got into housing? This is really interesting. It was after the Halifax explosion. Yeah. And what do you think happened in the program after the Halifax explosion. Anyone that knows this area of Halifax and knows its history might be able to guess. Anyone know how the program was unrolled and the problems with it?
Well, I'm sure there was like a racial divide.
Yes, this is exactly it. And so the federal government gets into this housing program, and the majority of people who were renters in Halifax North End mm-hmm. were black. Mm-hmm. And the federal government was like, you know what? Charge whatever rents you need to charge. And they pushed out the black community from Africville. And that's part of the story of the Halifax explosion of Africville. And to this day, I mean, the activism around commemorating that and reparations for the black community after the Halifax explosion are still really current things that are still happening. But this was the first time the federal government got into a housing program, and it was explicitly racist. And so, fast forward, 1950s start happening. The racism doesn't need to happen in the housing as much as it happens in the immigration policies. And we start to see these massively exclusionary immigration policies helps to maintain the whiteness of the Canadian, you know, population or whatever. And so, you know, we can look back and say, well, you did it without profit in the 40s and the 50s, and you built social housing in the 60s and the 70s, and you encouraged not-for-profit housing, you encouraged cooperative housing, and why are we where we are today? The answer is because the goals are still the same. Mm-hmm. The goals are still the same, but society has totally changed, and so the instruments are totally different. And if we don't wrap our heads around that, then we'll never understand why a policy is made that makes no sense, right? Because it doesn't make any sense under the logic of house everybody, make sure everyone's good, because that is not the logic of the ultra-rich in this country, of politicians in this country, and more importantly than any individual, than the system in this country. And we are so far from dismantling that system that we're always trying to be like, okay, what do we do? What do we do? Like, how can we make these small interventions? And it is the small interventions that actually make the biggest difference, because we are forced to work outside of that system.
Yeah, I mean, none of the logic makes any sense. It's like, it is... The logic is predicated on the idea that it is like an individual responsibility to be okay in life. But it is like, who relies on nobody in order to survive? Not a single person. Not a single person. To say it is your fault that you don't have housing, sitting wherever you might be, perhaps in a home that you inherited from family, is outrageous. And then to say, you know, that we're going to have this profit motive for housing, but it's your fault that you can't afford it. We don't have adequate minimum wage, but it's your fault that we don't have education and training that you can afford, but it is your fault. I mean, if you aren't set up in some way or have some sort of support around you, like, you cannot survive. And yet still, it is like an individual responsibility, so much so that people deserve, in the way that our society is constructed, to be punished for it. And I mean, like, the policy that doesn't make any sense. I mean, I feel like one of the most laughable things that was announced in the last couple of weeks, which we made fun of on our podcast, was asking credit agencies to, like, please consider rent as a part of credit, so that people can like be approved to take out a really massive loan that they'll then pay back to the bank, making the banks billions, trillions of dollars, so they can maybe buy a home and you know, maybe like credit agencies. I mean, I've been like reading up on it a little bit, and because I was just like, I want to know more about the history of credit. And so, like, 20 years ago in the 1980s,
good one.
Thank you. was really where that started to become a thing that was really necessary in life. This isn't like some truism that has to exist in our society, that you need credit to go to the grocery store, let alone buy a home, let alone construct a restaurant, if you want to, for members of your community. That is something that was like an idea that started in the 60s, was like super accelerated in the 80s and concretized in the 90s, and now nobody asks questions about it. So few questions that it's like when the prime minister says, we'll ask the credit agencies to like give you a hat tip if you're a good renter as a solution to a housing crisis. Logic. It's not there.
It is not.
It's like, it's almost as if we should provide the necessities of life, not connected to anybody like making billions of dollars. I don't know. It's a wild idea.
It's too wild of an idea. I'm going to do something to blow Sandy's mind. Watch this. We're almost at Q&A.
No, really? It's always so fast.
I know.
What is this?
We can keep going a couple times back and forth.
Okay.
And also, just actually, I should ask in the audience, raise your hand if you've never listened to our podcast before. I love you. I love all of you. For the listeners out there, many people raised their hands. Okay. So if you never listened to the podcast before, we usually run for about 45 to 50 minutes, and then at the live shows, we throw it to you. So I hope you are ready to take to the microphones, because we are going to do that the second we're finished, all right? And then that'll be the rest of the show is the Q&A, okay? So we'll get to that very soon.
Yeah, so start percolating, and it doesn't have to be on anything that we've talked about today, and it could be on the stuff that we've talked about today.
That's right. One of the things that I have been looking at very, very closely, and actually before I say this, on this question of mortgages and whatever, the CMHC, the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation, it was actually commercialized not that long ago. Mm. It used to be a builder of houses, not the backstop of Canadian mortgages. And they commercialized that in, I think it was the 1990s. And now the CMHC has to turn a profit, and they turn a massive profit every year backstopping Canadian mortgages. So this whole, like, everything that underpins our assumptions of property is on total display. And it's really sad. Like, I got into an argument yesterday with someone about the capital gains tax, and you know, they were like, but my retirement is selling my family's land and I shouldn't be taxed on it. And it's like, not taxed to the extent. And it's like, but that's not even how that works. And also, what's it like to have a fucking pension plan? You know, like, we have bought into this logic, and it's scary the extent that we've bought into it. But something that I have been researching a lot, and I think is the way that liberals, small L liberals, the conservatives are going to be right into this as well, are trying to solve some of these problems is through something called social finance. Does anyone know what social finance is? Just like applaud. Yeah, I got to talk to whoever applauded later on. Okay, so social finance is when money is poured into like groups of people to solve the problems of the day. And the groups tend to be universities or colleges, some sort of venture capitalists, and then government. So it's like Dragon's Den, but like on a campus. And rather than trying to sell like new kinds of fucking laundry detergent or something, you're trying to develop solutions to poverty and to crime and to the environment, okay? And in 2023, the federal government promised $700 million to social finance initiatives to be figured out by three social finance venture capitalist groups that operate in a not-for-profit way, okay, but they still make tons of money off of this, all right? And there's no information about who got the money and for what. If you look at other kinds of social finance models, like in Toronto, something called MARS, which maybe you've never heard of. Sandy, I know, absolutely despises MARS, the core of her being, and I do too. The kinds of solutions that we see are things like a company founded to help teachers write their lesson plans and manage their classrooms, and it's an app, and the school boards just have to pay a subscription to the app, and teachers love it because it takes time off their plate to just have a lesson plan for them. You're like, okay. That sounds fucking bad, actually. What if they need time to do the lesson plans? Let's just give them more time, right? Let's just pay them more. Let's just, no, we got an app to fix it, okay? Oh, but then it gets sold to a to a publicly traded American company that is going to jack the rates year over year because they need to pay out to their shareholders. And so you have public systems investing in these socially financed projects and then are totally commercialized, and then the profit is paid out to the private sector. Another example is a testing software that allows professors to have students, professors and teachers, but it works in larger volumes, to have students write their exams through the software, and the software marks it for you. That comes from the University of Waterloo, of course. And the math department there is using it. Right, and then the professor can look to see if there's any errors or whatever. And it's because they just have so many students. Like, they have no time for this, right? Any professors in the room? Not many, a couple. Like, your life sucks, right? Like, you have no time, and marking absolutely sucks, and everyone hates it, right? My partner's a professor of chemistry, he hates it. He's gotta mark 160 exams. But you have to do that to see your students. You have to look at the testing material. You have to see what they're doing. You have to go, oh, I don't make any sense. Okay, they put their name on the test. I'll give them at least a mark for that, you know? You can't outsource this to the machine. But the liberals see this as being the solution to our social problems, to bring together the corporate world, the academic world, and government. And that is how we're going to solve this stuff. And I'm very concerned that on the left, we've kind of missed the boat on this stuff, and it's happening quietly, and there's a fuckload of money in it, while we're all paying our own out of pocket to like make buttons and buy supplies and do our own things as much as we can. And that, again, tells the population that the solution lies in our problems, that the solution lies in the market. Even though 40 years after the shift to market-based everything, the shift to neoliberalism, we can see that it's the market that's fucking us.
Yeah, and I mean, part and parcel of that is just how much we have become the raw materials for people's wealth. Like we you know, whereas in another time, the raw materials were mainly being gathered from the land, being taken from the earth, and still are, of course, we are the raw materials now. So instead of the solution being like, if teachers don't have enough time, perhaps we either need more teachers for less students and more time for, like, you know, real solutions that are born out of policy and regulation and like solving the problem. It's how can we resolve this problem super, super quickly? How can we give money to someone where we can just be like, look, ha, here's some photos of this thing. Something new has been created. Ha ha. And that new thing that's been created is really without our consent, taking from us and building profit. I mean, one of the tools that we used to rail against quite a bit was, do you remember Turnitin.com?
No, I removed that part of my brain, so I never thought of it again.
Really?
Of course I remember Turnitin.com.
You know, it's like an AI company now?
How could it not be? It's been stealing essays for the last 15 years in schools across the world.
It's like teaching AI how to talk. Like that's what happened to all of our essays from all of those decades ago. And I'm sure at some point someone will pay me for that.
Oh, yeah?
You know.
You know, it's just too easy to be duped. And I think that in how confusing a lot of this stuff is, the people who are most vulnerable among us are also most susceptible to accepting the kind of solution that you talked about, that guy thinking the cabal of Biden and Trump is what's controlling the world. And it is which is dangerous. Mm-hmm. And it's dangerous for the individual. They get isolated from their family. I'm sure you all have people who you're worried about in your own lives who are falling into these spaces. And it's dangerous for society because we then don't have the ability to have real conversations about the problems that are facing us. And it's especially dangerous because you have someone like Pierre Poilievre who knows what's happening and just gives people exactly what he knows people want to hear. Someone like him is going to convince a whole lot of Canadians to vote against their self-interest. Someone like him is going to convince a lot of people to say, you know what, punch yourself in the face and like it. And people are going to go, okay, this works, you know? And we have to find ways to cut through that bullshit and make sure that people are understanding what the forces really are here. Mm-hmm. Because it isn't hard to see. It can be obvious, but it's confusing. And the logic has been so deeply ingrained in everything that we do that it's not just about talking about, you know, your mortgage or something like that. It's literally at every single touch point that we have within the market and within society is reinforcing this vicious right-wing fascistic logic. And we have to fight that with everything that we've got.
Yeah.